It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
Well, here we are, red freaking hot, on the heels of another sweep, on the heels of a seven-game winning streak. We can't gain any goddamn ground, but nevertheless, the Mets remain red hot. They complete a sweep over the Boston Red Sox. They are as hot as they have been all season long. And what's so great about this hot streak, and we'll get into details, is I don't even think they're playing their best baseball per se. Like, there are still things they're not doing as well as they can, and yet they've won seven consecutive games, including sweeping the Boston Red Sox. There's a lot to talk about here on this very happy edition of Rico Bronya. We'll obviously talk about the past two games against the Red Sox. We'll look ahead to Cincinnati. David Stearns made some comments that's gotten Met fans debating each other. Francisco Lindor's ridiculous season continues to get more ridiculous, and the Mets may have to make some pitching decisions. So we'll get to all that over the course of the Rico. But I have to admit, while I don't hate the Boston Red Sox, I really don't think much about the Boston Red Sox. There is something sweet. There is something special. There is something kind of nice to sweep a Boston team, to embarrass a Boston team, to watch a Boston team try to invade our building. And there were a handful of Red Sox fans there over the course of the last couple of days, and watch them with their annoying Boston accents suffer. Like, I enjoy that. There's the Jet fan in me that really enjoys it. There's the Brooklyn Net fan in me that really enjoys it. There's the Islander fan in me where, at least with those three teams, there's a genuine rivalry with Boston. There's a general dislike for those specific teams. Red Sox aren't like that for us. No, they aren't. In fact, there's a lot of Met fans that some may say like the Red Sox because they have been in the past, at least, an Achilles heel to the New York Yankees. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. But as I was sitting there in the ballpark on Wednesday night, the finale of this series, a part of why we were pretty late recording the Rico, my apologies, I was really enjoying the tears of Boston. And I wasn't necessarily thinking that was going to be the case going into this series. But a tremendous three-game sweep of the Boston Red Sox. And honestly, the MVP of this series and the MVP of this winning streak. Yeah, I could sit here and tell you Francisco Lindor, and he's been great. And there will be MVP discussions, I'm sure, around his name. But it's the bullpen. It's the part of the bullpen that we were so worried about. The part of the bullpen that was really setting this season on fire and got us very, very worried. And what we saw in the finale of this series, boy, did this excite me as a Met fan and as a baseball fan. Because what we saw, and yes, it all worked, and when things work, it feels a lot better than when they don't work, clearly. But what we witnessed in game three of this series was Carlos Mendoza going to work. Carlos Mendoza saying, okay, I got an off day on Thursday. I got a starting pitcher I do not trust in Tyler McGill, and I want this freaking baseball game, and I'm going to manage my ass off to get it. And that's what he did. And I get that one bad pitch or one double play not turned, or a great defensive play by Harrison Bader, which I do want to get into a little bit later on. If those things don't happen, yeah, there's a chance you're thinking I'm sitting here doing a Rico, ripping Mendy's overmanaging. I don't think I would, because I try to be fair about moves I like and dislike, and not just base it on does it work or not. Obviously, it's easy when something works to say, boy, that was some great managing. But as I'm sitting there on this gorgeous Wednesday night at Citi Field, and Tyler McGill is hittable, and you could tell he was hittable, honestly, from early on, because even in the first inning, first batter of the game made good contact. He gave up a lot of hard contact in the second inning. He obviously ran into the big trouble that he ran into in the third inning and was fortunate to get out of it. I thought he gave up a couple of game-tying home runs in that inning, but luckily it was a sack fly by Devers and a sack fly by Abreu. And you could tell in heaven. And when does Tyler McGill really do? When does he really have it? But when he gave up the leadoff hit in the fifth inning to Emmanuel Valdez, the eighth place hitter, and you're nursing a one-run lead, and Tanner Houck had settled down and pitched very well after that first inning, seeing Mendoza run out of that dugout to basically tell the world, I'm not effing around. I'm not taking this thing for granted. I'm going to manage my ass off to win this game. Oh, it made my heart a flutter. It really did. Because that was a sign early in this game, 4-3, runner on first, nobody out in the fifth inning. He announced to the world, I'm going to empty that tank here to try to win this game. And that was so beautiful to watch, especially because, and we'll go through what happened, nobody was perfect. Nobody dominated. Nobody made it easy. And Mendy had to continue to make decisions. So first up, he goes to Alex Young, the other Young, a guy who never deserved to be sent down to AAA, but was roster crunch, having options. And Alex Young comes into this game just to force Alex Cora's hand to say, all right, what is he going to do here? And Alex Young comes in, faces a couple of lefties, and gets the job done. He did give up a base hit to Jaron Duran, but then gets a huge double play against Rafael Devers. Rafael Devers did not have the greatest series in the world. He did not. And when he came up, 2-1, 1-out, Alex Young versus Devers, fifth inning, Young makes the biggest pitch in the world, gets the ground ball to second, and credit to McNeil and Lindor, who turned that double play beautifully. Then in the sixth inning, by going to Alex Young, you force Cora as a platoon manager to start to empty his bench, to go to Rob Refsnyder. Alex Young fails because he walks Refsnyder. What does Mendy do? He manages right along. He says, time for Waskar Brazoban. Let me see what Waskar can do. And after Waskar issued his walk, and there were two on and nobody out, I don't think any of us were feeling good. Because nursing a 4-3 lead, and I said this to Sean Morash and Tommy Lugauer, who are with me at this game tonight or last night, and I said to them, four runs is not going to be enough. Like, this bullpen is not going to protect a one-run lead, needing to get as many outs as they were being asked to get when you go to the bullpen with nobody out in the fifth inning. By the way, I turned out to be wrong about that, which I'm glad. But he goes to Brazoban. He gets the huge flyout of Yoshida, and then another big double play. The big double play, they got three of them in three consecutive innings, were so huge. And the one against Casas was the easiest one in the world because it was a little ground ball to shortstop. He lets Brazoban start the seventh inning against a couple of right-hand hitters, gives up a hit, gets an out, and then says, boom, time for Danny Young. Let me force Cora's hand and have to go to the bench, which he does, pinch hitting for Sogard. And what does Danny Young do? Our man Danny Young, Alex Young. We love all the Youngs. He gets Romy Gonzalez to ground into that 4-6-3 double play, which I thought Romy beat it out, but I was dead wrong. He lets Young start the eighth against the lefties, of course. And what does Danny Young do? He gets the job done. Ground out on Duran, strike out on Devers, two outs, nobody on. Great. Let me go to Phil Maton now. Now, Maton made things dicey, and this is where we give Bader a ton of credit for his defense, because that base hit by Refsnyder to right center field should be a double. And Bader's defense, and this is why you got to emphasize defense with this outfield when you're Carlos Mendoza. That's what pissed me off so much a few days ago when we were stuck looking at the most mediocre defensive outfield in the world. I'm trying to remember who was out there that I was complaining about. It was Brandon Nimmo and somebody else. I can't even remember. But Bader running that ball down, making a great throw in and holding Refsnyder to a single really did save the game because Tyler O'Neill got a base hit right after that. Look, this was Phil Maton's shakiest outing because even the out he got after making things dicey with two on and two out was a line drive off the bat of Yoshida where Lindor paused, waited, and made the great leaping catch. But think about all of those moves that Mendy was making and the matchups he was playing. And everybody picked each other up. Nobody was dominant. I guess you could argue Danny Young was. He retired everybody he faced. But outside of that, every bullpen arm he used would get into trouble, either get out of it or someone else would get out of it and somehow got it to Edwin Diaz in the ninth inning. And luckily, in the bottom of the eighth inning, the Met offense was able to erupt. And by erupt, I say that sarcastically. They did not erupt. They just watched Kenley Jansen and Dick Mountain walk the ballpark. And that's okay. No one's complaining about that. Three bases loaded walks in a row and a sacrifice fly? Fine. Bottom line is it took a game that was close, a game that was dicey, a game that I think most of us figured they're going to blow this, especially needing as many outs from their bullpen as they did. They were able to break the game open, and then Edwin Diaz was going to come in anyway, and he looked great. He was throwing probably as hard as he's thrown all year. I thought this was marvelous managing by Carlos Mendoza. I thought it was another example, and we've seen this now for a few weeks, where the non-obvious guys in this bullpen continued to be great. Alex Young, Waskar Brazoban, Danny Young, Phil Maton, and Edwin Diaz find a way to pitch five scoreless innings. Now, I do want to ask a question, because I wondered about this as Mendy was putting on a clinic managing. I don't necessarily agree with everything he did, because there was something he did in both games against the Red Sox, the final two games of this series, that I want to wonder aloud about. And we can have a nice, fun debate about such. Edwin Diaz, despite some moments this year in which he has broken our hearts, specifically the grand slam to Corbin Carroll, what feels like 10 months ago, but it was only a week ago, the last time the Mets lost the game, I think most of us would agree Edwin Diaz remains their best reliever. I would love to see Carlos Mendoza do something that Buck Showalter did a lot last year, and that's not basically say Edwin Diaz is my ninth inning guy. So I thought more so in game two of this series than even in this game, but sure, we'll use this game as an example. There are two outs and nobody on in the eighth inning, and it's Rob Refsnyder, Tyler O'Neill, and Masataka Yoshida, three of the better Red Sox hitters since you got past Devers and Durant. Wouldn't Edwin Diaz be the guy that you would trust to get that final out of the eighth inning and maybe also pitch the ninth inning? I was even thinking to start the eighth inning. Like after Danny Young got the double play, it's the top of the Red Sox order with a one-run lead. Wouldn't this be the moment to use my best reliever? And then you worry about the ninth inning based on what happens. Like in this case, the Mets broke the game open. So Edwin Diaz getting those pivotal outs in the eighth inning would have been the most important outs. But I really thought about that a night earlier. Because a night earlier, after Jose Budo walked back-to-back guys, and again, the Mets were protecting a very little lead. It was 3-1 at the time in the eighth inning. And you've got two on and nobody out with Rafael Devers up. My thought was, why am I screwing around with Reed Garrett when I could go for the hammer with Edwin Diaz? So that's my one kind of differing view with Carlos Mendoza. And I wonder if Diaz's struggles in the eighth inning when he gave up the grand slam to Corbin Carroll may be a factor in why he doesn't want to do that and he doesn't want to bring him in with guys on base. Because when he's done that this season, Edwin hasn't been as effective as he was two seasons ago. But nevertheless, I put that thought in everybody's head because I think there is going to be a day in which this isn't going to work. And we are going to question and complain, hey, how come the best reliever wasn't used in the biggest spot of the game? In this case, or two nights ago, it was Reed Garrett. And in this case, it was Danny Young / Phil Maton. But the reality is this bullpen, and this is so shocking, but not shocking. It's shocking because the Met bullpen was so bad. It's not shocking because, as I've said many times, bullpens don't make any sense. Relievers don't make any sense. Good to bad, bad to good. It's why I liked what they did at the trade deadline. They took lottery tickets out. They took flyers out. Now, Phil Maton is one of those flyers, but a few of the other flyers are guys that were already here that are just pitching better. You know, Danny Young has now become a major weapon. Jose Budo has cooled off, but as he's cooled off, Reed Garrett starts to look a lot better. And over the course of this 7-game winning streak, and I started talking about this a few days ago, but it has certainly continued here at the tail end of this Boston series, it's the bullpen. It's the bullpen that's really been their strength. Because right now, over the course of this 7-game winning streak, the lack of big hits at times, it feels like they've left runs on the board. Maybe not as much in game two of this series when they broke the game open late. The offense can sometimes disappear for long periods of time, as we saw in the finale of this series when they score the four in the first inning on the Winker Grand Slam and then do nothing after that until the eighth inning. And yet, despite that, they're winning every single day. and they're winning every single day because their bullpen has been tremendous. We saw David Peterson continue his brilliant pitching performance as he did in that 11 strikeout, six glorious inning start in game two of this series. And right now, everything's working. Well, everything's not working, but everything's working in that they're winning. Like Pete Alonso has another example of something that's not necessarily clicking. Pete Alonso had a very frustrating game in the finale of this series to the point where when he struck out in the eighth inning with the bases loaded, he broke his bat on his knee. Wasn't with the bases loaded at that time. It was with two on and nobody out. And Pete was pissed off and he broke his bat and he was angry and he's frustrated. And he's frustrated because he continues to have this like really inconsistent season. You know, Pete Alonso hit the home run in the eighth inning. I think the game was pretty much out of reach at that point. I don't want to rip him for that. It happens. But he also came up and struck out a few times earlier in that game. You saw what happened in the finale of this series. He came up to start the game with the bases loaded and nobody out, and he struck out. So Pete Alonso has not clicked. They're doing this without J.D. Martinez, who's now missed a couple of days. Congratulations to him. He's on the paternity list. They've done this with a lot of inconsistencies from their lineup, but the one consistency is Francisco Lindor. You know, we could, I don't want to say waste time, but I could waste your time by saying the obvious things about Francisco Lindor and how brilliant he's been. I could do that, but do you need me to do it? We're all watching it. We all see how great this guy's been. We all see how clutch he's been. We all see how he's getting on base multiple times a game. We all see how great his defense is. We all see how incredibly valuable he is. And let me just say something about that, about the debate. I can't wait to have an MVP debate. But you know what? I'm not going to do it even here on the Rico. I'm not going to do it now in the middle of the season. When this season is over and the script has been written, I can't wait to have a debate on if he has won the MVP or not. Because the MVP award is based on hypotheticals. I'll give you one hypothetical right off the top. And I know that there will be a few people that disagree with me on this, but I feel very strongly about this, especially in this case. You got to make the playoffs. And really, that's all I care about. Francisco Lindor winning the MVP and being the first Met to ever win the MVP, sure, that's cool. But you know what's cooler? Making the playoffs. And those two things are related. As great as he's been, as valuable as he's been, as much as I would argue his numbers, which are now undeniably good, undeniably really good, I think he's been better than what his numbers would even tell you. I think all of us would agree with that. You watch him every day. You see the leadership. You remember the team meeting. You see the clutch hits. You see the consistency that he's had since the middle of May. And I would argue, yeah, the numbers are great. He's playing better than even the numbers indicate. That's what I'd say about Francisco Lindor. But MVP debates kind of annoy me because at the end of the day, we care a hell of a lot more about making the playoffs than an award that's going to be handed out in the middle of November. But he has earned now being a part of that conversation for those that want to have it. But I want him in the postseason. And if the Mets make the postseason, and obviously it's a regular season award, so anything that happens after that, completely irrelevant. But I can't wait to do that very special Rico Bronya, hopefully the first week in November, where we break down MVP candidate number one, Shohei Ohtani, and MVP candidate number two, Francisco Lindor. The same thing with David Stern's comments. He's putting together the greatest regular season by an offensive player in Met history. Well, it ain't over yet. And a lot of things can happen that will change all of our opinions on where this stands in Met history. Because as much as numbers matter, I was thinking about this after David made that comment. I said, forget Lindor for a second. Hey, off the top of my head, before I go to Baseball Reference, who's had the greatest offensive season in Met history? And I remembered how good David Wright was in 2007, but I couldn't bring myself to saying that. You want to know why? I think everyone knows why. Because they choked like dogs and missed the playoffs. And talking about David Wright, who was not terrible in September, I'm not blaming the choke necessarily on David, but you're the best player who had this great MVP caliber season, on a team that choked. Tough for me to say that's the greatest season in the history of the New York Mets. Now, it's easy all these years later if you want to be non-emotional about it and just look at stats and say, well, his war was this and he hit this and he drove in this. That's all great. If we just want to do this by stats, sure, it's up there. Maybe it's the best. But can we really separate the fact that the 2007 Mets are known as chokers? I can't do that. I mean, that's just me. But it's funny when David Stearns made that comment. I thought to myself, this guy, Lindor, is signed for so long that the GM / team president is comfortable saying this is the greatest year ever because they don't have to worry about paying him. He's not thinking about, well, I don't want to say that. That guy's a free agent at the end of the year. I don't want to say that. That guy's a free agent in 2 years. But nevertheless, Lindor is having a brilliant season. And on an individual day-by-day basis, he impacts this team in such an incredible way. You look at the finale of this series, leadoff hit. That leadoff hit was big. Helped set the tone for the game. Put a bunch of guys on base. Led to Jesse Winker's grand slam. And how good has Jesse Winker been? It's amazing how Jesse Winker's waving to the crowd was the most obnoxious thing in the world a few years ago. And after he hit that grand slam and he started waving to the crowd, I waved back. I think the last time he was waving at us, back when he was a Red, I didn't wave back. I gave him the middle finger back. So it's funny. It's funny what sports can do to how you feel. But major credit, I want to go back to game two of this series to David Peterson. I forget what start David Peterson made. It was probably about 3 weeks ago. I think it may have been against the Orioles. So, yeah, a few weeks ago. And we were doing a drive home, Rico. And I said, I don't know if you guys are there yet, but I'm in. I believe in David Peterson. And I think we all got there at a very different point. Now there's no denying it. I don't think there's anybody left who doesn't believe in David Peterson. And I'm stunned by it. I don't it. I can't remind you how many times we talked about, hey, can David Peterson prove he should be a part of this rotation? Can Tyler McGill? It's amazing they were even in the same sentence. Tyler McGill, nothing has changed. David Peterson, everything has changed. What really impressed me about David Peterson's performance the other night and continues to impress me about David Peterson's performances is his ability to get that big out and make that big pitch when he needs to. You know, you go back to the fifth inning of this game, it looked like the Red Sox were going to come back on David Peterson. He got off to the great start. He was striking the world out. And in the fifth inning, gave up a little cheapy infield hit to Yoshida. And then eventually gave up that bloop RBI single to Sogard. And it's a 2-1 game. And then he gives up a base hit to Ref Snyder. And now Jaron Duran, one of the Red Sox best players, comes up with a couple of guys on base, couple of outs, fifth inning. And this game has a chance to turn. And he struck out Duran. I think it was on a rising fastball, if memory serves correct. And then he gets into trouble in the sixth inning. Puts guys on base. Puts two guys on base. And again, makes the big pitch when he needs to. And that, to me, has been the difference between the David Peterson of now and the David Peterson that was frustrating us. He shows poise in these big spots. He's not losing the strike zone uncontrollably like we've seen in the past. So whether it's magical hip surgery, whether it's just learning at the knee of Jeremy Hefner, whether it's maturity, whether it's lefties develop late, which we always tell ourselves when there's a lefty struggling year after year, see Jonathan Nease, and most of the time it doesn't turn around. Whatever the reason, it is now clicking for David Peterson. And what David Peterson has done, not that I want to think too much about the offseason, but I do remember back in March when we were talking about the hopes of this season, but then the hopes of next season, knowing that, hey, a lot of these starting pitchers they have are on one-year deals or abilities for there to be one-year deals. Sean Manaea's deal is clearly going to be a one-year deal because he's opting out. How can he not, considering the season he's having? And you looked at all these guys on short-term deals, and you looked at, okay, Senga will be here, and you've got prospects in the system. Hopefully, somebody or somebodies comes up and limits the amount of arms this team is going to have to add in free agency. So they're not going to have to add four starting pitchers in free agency. And David Peterson, and I would even say no matter what happens over the final few starts that he makes this season, obviously things can go bad, and maybe they'll go bad in the worst possible time. But I think what David Peterson has proven is not only is he a lock to be a postseason starter if the Mets are fortunate enough to make it, but he is a clear part of the 2025 plan. He was the guy, little did we expect it, to step up and say, I'm going to be a part of this rotation in the future. He has had an excellent, excellent season. The offense in game two of this series was very similar. It didn't do much, but they got the big hit when they needed to. Lindor hitting the two-run home run off Cutter Crawford. Vientos hitting the home run in the seventh inning that gave them the important insurance run. And then, and it's two nights in a row, breaking the game open in the eighth inning against the Boston bullpen. In game three of the series, they did it based on just walks. In game two of this series, they did it based on an RBI double by Lindor, a sac fly by Nimmo, and then Pete Alonso putting the icing on the cake by hitting the two-run home run. What a glorious, glorious three-game series against the Boston Red Sox. Paul Blackburn will be on his way back, and that is decision points that the Mets are going to have to make. Andy Martino dropped a little piece that Kodai Senga expects to return and return as a starter. That Senga was so impressive in the bullpen he threw the other day that there is an expectation Kodai Senga could make a start at the end of this season. So I was thinking about this because when the report came out a few days ago of, hey, Senga could make it back, there were a couple of thoughts went into my head. The first thought was, I love that the Mets, and I wish that they had done this a lot in the past, and I wish a lot of my teams did this, they went the other way with an injury. They told us, he's done. Don't even ask questions about him. Yeah, that guy's done for the season. And then they came back after a few weeks and said, actually, he's going to make it back. Isn't that a lot better than saying this guy's out 6 to 8 weeks and then 6 to 8 weeks go by and that guy's nowhere to be found? It's almost as if they oversold the Senga injury. I like that. I prefer to go that way. Lower expectations. But my other thought was, all right, he's going to be a reliever. And there's no way he's going to have enough time to stretch himself out. But in this world we live in of the designated hitter, so you don't need to double switch or do anything like that, you could have piggyback arms. It's an absolute option. If Kodai Senga is good enough to start and they feel more comfortable with him having that routine as a starting pitcher, getting three or four scoreless innings out of him isn't the craziest thing in the world. You could back that up with Jose Quintana or Paul Blackburn or whoever you're thinking could piggyback that. So there's no negative to the idea that Kodai Senga can come back. As far as the short term is concerned, Paul Blackburn has mostly been good since the trade that they made with the Oakland Athletics. Tyler McGill goes to the bullpen. And I would keep him in the bullpen because I do think there's a value to having a long man in your bullpen. Now, who goes down at this point? It's a little bit more complicated because you really don't have anybody that's worthy of going down. Alex Young should be here. Danny Young should be here. Even Waskar Brazoban should be here. Adam Ottavino, I know, is a fair whipping boy. I just screw him. Get rid of him. But I do like the idea of having a long reliever in this bullpen, and Tyler McGill would certainly fill that with Paul Blackburn coming back next week when they're in Toronto.
You know, speaking of the bullpen and just the arms that you have and options you may have, I don't know if you've looked at Shintaro Fujinami's numbers. In the past, since August 17th, he's combined 9 scoreless innings, 1 hit, 2 walks, 13 strikeouts. I mean, is he someone that's an option? Because talk about Adam Ottavino, you know, hit or miss stuff at times. Would that be someone you want to experiment with in the last month of the season?
I can't believe I'm saying this, but right now, no, only because all of their options are pitching well. I mean, think about it. Like, especially Brazoban, who would have been the odd man out. Waskar Brazoban did a pretty damn good job in this game against Boston. He was asked to get very big outs after Alex Young. And I know he walked the guy, but he did get a huge double play, got a huge strike out of Valdez. Like, Brazoban would probably be the guy you would option down because he has the options. And I guess if you're power ranking all of these relievers. But yeah, I've seen that he's pitching well, Fujinami, but I'm not in any rush to call him up because as of right now, all of these options in the bullpen are pitching relatively well, and they all deserve to be here.
Now, if Kodai Senga was to come back, you said he'd be a starter.
Is what Martino is reporting, and the Mets kind of feel he would be more comfortable doing. Yeah.
But even though he said he was open to doing bullpen?
Well, I think Senga, and look, McGill said the same thing. Of course, I'll do anything to help this team. I don't think anybody's demanding that they be in the rotation. I think it's more the Mets saying, okay, if we have a healthy Kodai Senga, who's been stretched out to where he could pitch three or four innings, how do we want to deploy him? And, you know, one thing that's so difficult when we talk about moving starters to the bullpen, Yankee fans have been doing it a lot lately with Luis Gil and Clark Schmidt, is there's an adjustment that one has to make when you've never done it before. You know, Kodai Senga has a process getting ready to make a start. How is that translated to, hey, you're going to come in and pitch the seventh inning? Oh, wait, I'm not sure when the seventh inning is going to start. Oh, wait, actually, we want you to come in a little bit later or maybe a little bit earlier. Like, there's a process to becoming a reliever. And I don't know if they believe Senga is so much a creature of habit that, yeah, of course, he's willing to do it, but how is he going to adjust to that? I also think this is kind of weird because he's not eligible to come off until the final week of the season. The Mets are showing you, you know, barring a collapse, they're going to be in it going into the final week of the year. Is that going to be your best option? And how do you deploy it? Like right now, my gut would tell me there are three starting pitchers who I want there starting. I want them out there as often as possible in the final few weeks of the season, and I want them pitching the biggest games possible. And those three guys I think are pretty obvious. It's David Peterson, it's Sean Manaea, and it's Luis Severino. Jose Quintana has been shaky. He has earned nothing. The fifth spot, Paul Blackburn, he's been better than Tyler McGill. I wouldn't put him in that kind of top three area. So those three guys I prioritize saying, hey, I want them out there final week of the year. But if you're giving me a choice between Quintana, Senga, and Blackburn, that's where it's like, hey, let's see if they can get three or four innings out of Kodai Senga and then piecing together the rest of said game.
One thing I do want to mention, you go back to what you were talking about with Edwin Diaz, your thoughts on how Mendoza's using him and you wish you'd be able to use him a little bit different. Like, hey, the biggest spot is a seventh or eighth inning. You got these three hitters that you just need to get out. Problem is, I still don't think that Mendoza even knows what the heck he's doing with him anyway. Like, the last 2 days, he didn't use him because he couldn't. He couldn't use him Monday. They had to go to
Maton.
Maton with the save. Stanek yesterday, the game was getting out of hand. Stanek was the guy that closed it. Okay,
fine. He was going to come in game two of this series, but once they broke it open, he held him off.
Sure. But then today, and I understand there's an off day tomorrow, but like, it's a five-run lead at this point in time. Why bring him in now?
I'll tell you why. So there's a big difference between game two and in game three. I think in game two's case, remember, Edwin's pitched a lot recently, which is why he wasn't available Monday. I think if he pitched Monday, he would have pitched five times in 6 days, which is even too much for Diaz, even though he's better with work. I think you hold him off Tuesday once you bring the game open because you want him to be available Wednesday. But now that he hasn't pitched Monday and Tuesday, and you're not playing a game on Thursday, if you don't pitch him in the finale of this series once he was already warming up, now you went from I'm using Edwin too much to I'm not using him enough because now he has four consecutive off days. And one thing we've seen about Diaz is he's better when he pitches. So I think that game three of this series, and I was saying this to the guys, I was with Loogie and Sean at this game because they were even saying, I think Sean left, but Loogie was still there. Why is Diaz coming into this game? And I was like, because they have an off day tomorrow and because they want to balance, Mendy wants to balance, not overworking Edwin Diaz, of course, but having him work enough because he is better with a decent workload. They've got three games coming up this weekend against Cincinnati. Obviously, yes, all three could become save situations. Is he going to pitch in all three, which would make it three straight games, second time this year, four out of five? Probably not. But I also think you don't want him to get what's the opposite of what's it underwork? Called flat. What is it called when you don't pitch enough? Whatever that freaking word
shitty.
Is. Yes. That's the word I'm looking for. So I had no problem with it. And I wasn't surprised by it either once they broke the game open because he'd also used a big part of the bullpen. He wasn't going to go to Budo again. He wasn't going to go to Reed Garrett again. I guess he could have gone to Ryan Stanek, but it was all about let me keep Edwin Diaz. Let me keep him in his groove. It is amazing, and I give Diaz a lot of credit for this, and really the Mets as a whole, they have fought back from adversity all season long. I think from the get-go, from the beginning of this season on, when they lost the first five games to start against Milwaukee. That loss against Arizona, and I think I remember saying this when we did the instant reaction to that brutal Corbin Carroll Grand Slam game. This is the worst loss of the season, but it's all going to be about how they respond. This could be the death sentence. This could be the game that we all remember as what ended this season. No doubt about it. But what if they respond? And I don't think any of us would have thought that the response to that was going to be this, which is not only winning the last game against Arizona, not only sweeping the Chicago White Sox, a team that you basically have to sweep, but now against a Red Sox team that, you know, was in a pennant race. I think the Mets are trying to eliminate that very quickly, that they would go in there and sweep them too. So it's amazing how hot they are, and especially because of the way it started. The one negative, and I'm not blaming the Mets for this, they can't control this, is that they're just not getting help. And that's the frustrating thing. They're in the midst of maybe their best run of the year. I guess you can compare it to their previous seven-game winning streak, where they swept San Diego, won the first two games against Texas, and then they finally lost that finale against the Rangers, and that snapped that winning streak. But right now, they are playing some of their best baseball and then not gaining ground. You know, you look up and you see the Braves beating the Rockies. Not that anybody's surprised by that. You look up and you see Arizona responding. You know, as long as the Diamondbacks aren't playing the Mets or the Dodgers, they're going to be fine. And so that is the one big negative to all this, that you would think with a seven-game winning streak, the Mets would finally take a wild card spot, and they haven't been able to do it. So it's a little frustrating. Not their fault. Got to keep winning. It's all you can do. Now, let me get to some of your emails. TheRicoB@gmail.com. Ralph writes, the Mets are now 54-31 since the transformational team meeting brought them back from the abyss. They're the hottest team in baseball with a seven-game winning streak, yet they can still miss the playoffs. Because I believe for a while that their destiny is to go to Atlanta needing two out of three to make the playoffs. Can they do it? History in Atlanta has shown that they won't, but maybe this year is different. But isn't it interesting that both the Mets and the Yankees on September 24th will play three games that could be the final determination of their playoff position or the final determination of if they'll make it at all in the case of the New York Mets? Also very interesting, unrelated side note. You talked on The Fan the other day about how a big game it would be for the Giants. Well, I think it's somewhat... why am I reading about this? This is about the Giants now. Sorry. And the Jets. That's the problem. I'm sorry. I'm reading fresh emails, and he was going off on the Giants and Jets. I'm sorry, Ralph. I'll answer that one on WFAN. Thank you very much. Dan. Negative Dan wants to give you a little negativity on a seven-game winning streak. I am curious what that would be. I've never seen a media fan base have to yell and scream about how good their players are like this team. We get it. Lindor is out of this world right now. But like you said on air today, worry about making the damn playoffs and the award crap will take care of itself. This is like the Brandon Nimmo all-star BS all over again. That aged well. The job is not even close to finished. And I could care less what accolades these guys get when they've made the playoffs one time since they've been together. Literally none of it matters. And can all be erased the second they step foot in the ballpark, where our season has gone to die more times than I can count. He's referring to the Atlanta series as well. I can't help but feel like all these dirty little secrets this team has are going to come to a head at the worst possible time. The 5 billion strikeouts a night, the fact more often than not that they basically score in one inning a game and try to hold on for dear life, the lack of situational hitting with runners in scoring position, and they have a chance to put teams away early. Some of the most boneheaded base running that goes untalked about. And, of course, the walks from our pitchers. This staff and pen has been phenomenal holding this thing together on an absolute tightrope. And you just got to feel eventually it's going to give way. And I have a hard time trusting this offense is going to come through and pick them up when they're needed the biggest, a.k.a. September 24th, 25th, and 26th. That, of course, is the Atlanta series. We have 3 weeks before we get to that series, a series that very well may determine everything. Right now, the Mets are a half game behind the Atlanta Braves. The Braves are going to play Thursday night against Colorado, probably win, and make it a one-game lead. I have said this before. I will say it again. Even on a seven-game winning streak, I would sign today to go into that Atlanta series one game out. I still would. I still would sign for that. I would still sign for everything being in our hands going into that series. With that said, am I going to be brimming with confidence going into a place that not just this team, but our team as kids, or if you weren't a kid, maybe you've read about it, always seem to die in, even though it's a different ballpark, but the same city? I'm probably not going to have a lot of confidence. I'm not going to lie to you about that. But as of right now, I can't worry about that. And you shouldn't worry about that. What you should worry about is they're about to play the Cincinnati Reds. Go beat the Cincinnati Reds. Maybe the Atlanta Braves get tripped up. Maybe I'm wrong. And the Mets aren't going into the Atlanta series a game out. They're going into the Atlanta series four games up. Wouldn't that be a damn dream? Michael writes, huge fan of the Rico. Absolutely pumped up about this seven-game winning streak. I'm not trying to be a Debbie Downer, but I've been meaning to mention this since Dednil Nunez returned in San Diego and pitched an inning and two-thirds and is now experiencing a dead arm. Did anyone else raise the eyebrows that in his very first game back after a 30-day IL stint, Mendoza went to him for more than one inning? I remember saying, he must be feeling 100%, only to learn that he didn't recover well after the outing. Well, of course he didn't. Mendoza pushed him over an inning in his very first appearance off the IL. It seemed crazy to me at the time, and now it seems reckless. Anyway, a lot to celebrate and be positive about, but felt like this point hasn't been made regarding Nunez. I honestly didn't even think about that. It's definitely a fair point. I thought when Nunez pitched, I was so enamored by how good he looked and how he was getting his work in that I didn't think, wow, they pushed him too much. I wonder if that's going to injure him. I'm not sure if going that long was necessarily going to injure him. I mean, he may have been injured even if he only pitched that one inning, but I do admit it's a nice thought, Michael. I didn't think about it. I was good with Nunez pitching. It stinks he has the dead arm. There is a chance he can come back. And he was so good in that one appearance that he made that you bring him back, I'd instantly throw him into a high leverage situation. Junior writes, wow, seven in a row, LGM. Evan, I have a bone to pick with you. Uh-oh. I remember in the drunk Rico, you said the Mets were done. Here we are, 12 games over 500. First of all, I didn't say they were done. I said they're probably not going to make the playoffs. If you give me the truth serum, I don't think they're going to make the playoffs. And by the way, I'll say this right now. Seven-game winning streak, very much pumped up, as we all should be. Do I think at the end of the day the Mets are going to make the playoffs? I still don't think they are. I hope I'm wrong. But proverbial, I don't want to say gun to my head. Let me think of something else. Proverbial, your ass is in the jackpot. Do I think they're going to make the playoffs? And we can do this test after every series. We can do it to ourselves. Hey, do you think they're going to make the playoffs? Hey, do you think they're going to make the playoffs now? Probably not. And here's a part of why. Listen to this email, and then I'm going to go to sleep. Ian writes, if the Mets win 90 games and don't make the playoffs, how do you react? With both the Mets and Braves absolutely rolling for the past few months, I'm starting to wrestle with the idea that our club could potentially win 90-ish games and still not make the playoffs. I think if that happened, it would be a very tough pill to swallow because, for one, I'd have a hard time getting on this team if they lost out on the third wild card while winning 90 games. They've played fantastic ball for a long stretch, but it seems like the Braves never lose. I'm wondering how you'd react to a potential finish where we do the opposite of collapse. We have a very strong finish, but come up short. Is that more or less frustrating to you than other outcomes? Let's hope this doesn't come to fruition, but wondering your thoughts. So the more days go by, the more that could happen. Like it could. You know, they could win more games than I predicted at the beginning of the season and not make the playoffs. You know, they could win 90 games and not make the playoffs. I'd be lying to you to say I'd be reacting by saying, it's okay. It's just bad luck. Because if they don't make the playoffs, especially now being a half game out and being right there, there will have been losses that helped contribute to that. Even if it wasn't a collapse, there would have been losses. They're going to play three games in Atlanta against the Braves. They're not going to win that series, presumably. That will probably stick with me, and that will probably stick with all of us. So I think there would be great, great disappointment, especially when you're this close. But that's what's making this so challenging. That, and we talked about this a few days ago with the strength of schedule, the Mets have one of the most difficult schedules to close this season, and the Red Sox are a part of that, an above 500 team, and the Braves have the weakest. Now, luckily, it's not just Atlanta. Can the San Diego Padres lose enough games? Can the Arizona Diamondbacks lose enough games? Because again, the Mets aren't that far off when you look at how they trail those teams. I mean, they are only three games back of San Diego and Arizona. So presumably one of them needs to trip up and the Mets continue to play really good baseball. But right now in the moment, with an off day on Thursday, and a chance to take a nice, big, deep breath with football returning, the Mets are playing their best baseball. They are 12 games above 500. They have won seven in a row. And obviously, they have to keep that going over the weekend against the Cincinnati Reds. Pressure's on. Gotta keep winning. But right now, it's a good time to be alive. It's a good time to be enjoying New York Mets baseball. Is Francisco Lindor having the best year in the history of the New York Mets? We're actually going to do a deep dive on that. As much as I don't want to have that discussion until the season is over, we're going to give you an optional Rico Bronya coming up in the next couple of days where you'll get to hear that discussion. But if you're like me and you don't want to hear that discussion, don't download that edition of Rico. Just skip it and skip right into the Mets Red Series. But we will give you that discussion in the next couple of days, where it ranks and what, in my opinion, is the greatest season offensively in the history of the New York Mets. So take a listen to that. Remember to subscribe to Rico Bronya wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. Thank you very much for listening, downloading, and enjoying yourself on another winning edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.